BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello. Coming up today, sore throats and headlines prompted by new research suggesting that persistent soreness can be a sign of cancer of the larynx. To shave or not to shave? That's the question prompted by Andy Murray's hairy arms in a photograph taken after his recent hip operation. Margaret McCartney has been investigating the pros and the cons. And cutting out the carbs to treat epilepsy. I meet the parents who are using diet to help their son's seizures.
So he's tried four different medications and none of them have helped.
Yeah. Did all the medicines that he was taking, did they have an effect on him?
Yeah, he's very, very sleepy. In November, we had clinic with our neurologist. He wanted to add another drug and just up his medication, and then I had to say no because it's not Edward anymore. He's just like a different child. So then he said the alternative is that he could be referred to go on to a ketogenic diet.
More from Edward and his family later. But first, we continue last week's genetics theme with a fascinating legal case that hit the headlines recently. A woman with Huntington's disease, an inherited, incurable neurological condition, is suing the hospital trust that looked after her father who had it for not warning her that she could be affected too. The outcome of her case could profoundly change doctors' responsibilities to the families of patients with inheritable illnesses. To debate how, I'm joined by GP Dr. Margaret McCartney and Anna Middleton, who's a genetic counsellor and head of society and ethics at the Wellcome Sanger Institute in Cambridge.
He was explicit in telling the doctors looking after him that he didn't want his daughters to know because one of them was pregnant, and he was concerned that if she found out that she was at risk of Huntington's, that she would have a termination of pregnancy. It came out in the court case that he'd actually told other relatives, but he was very explicit about not telling his daughters. And so the daughter who was pregnant then went on to have her child, and then she apparently started to experience symptoms herself of Huntington's, and that was the point where she realised that this was an inherited condition and it was likely to have come from her father. So she then asked the doctors caring for her father, well, why didn't you forewarn me? And they said, well, we couldn't breach his confidentiality. And so she's now suing the NHS Trust looking after her father for her duty and her right to have this information because she said she would have ended the pregnancy.
Margaret, can I just ask you what your first impression was when you read this? Because it's quite a striking story.
It is, and it's a very sad story on many levels as well. I have to say my first reaction when I read this was, oh no, what will happen if there's a change and we are formally required to notify all relatives of a person who is diagnosed with having a serious genetic condition by rote. So there are lots of rules about confidentiality, and the General Medical Council are very clear about how important confidentiality is. But there is also the knowledge that confidentiality is not absolute, in the words of the GMC. But up till now, there have been very strict rules about when it is a doctor's duty to break confidentiality. And to be honest with you, they are few and far between.
What was fascinating for me, because I sat in the public gallery at the Court of Appeal on this, was to hear the three judges talking about the exceptional circumstances. And they were very explicit in saying, we're not expecting all doctors in all situations to be tracking down relatives and forewarning them of information. And the GMC have got very clear guidelines on when it might be appropriate to breach somebody's confidentiality to share information with a relative. And there are certain very specific situations. And when you're trying to protect harm in others and you can clearly show that you've weighed up the risks and the benefits of sharing that information, then you can do that. And certainly working in clinical genetics over the last 30, 40 years in that practice, it has happened where family information is shared with relatives, even though the initial patient is not keen on that. But what's really striking about this particular case is it first went to court and then it was struck out by the first judge, who said, you know, the rule of confidentiality outweighs absolutely everything else. And then it was the Court of Appeal where the three judges sat and heard the case again and said, no, actually, we overturn the first judgment and we say there is reasonable grounds to challenge this. And actually getting to that point where they were saying there was a reasonable potential duty to warn, was enough. Because I think up until that point, people actually really were quite nervous about following the guidelines, because you don't want to be sued for breaking somebody's confidentiality. But you do, particularly with strongly inherited genetic conditions where a gene variant does equal disease, which isn't the case for all conditions, and where you can actually do something to prevent harm. There's quite a strong argument that you should. But what I think particularly about this case that is concerning is that although there is an existence of a duty to warn in certain situations, that isn't a legal duty. And I think turning that into law is something quite different.
To be clear, at the moment we have professional guidance on when we should think about this, but we're not under a legal obligation to do so. But if this woman was to win her appeal case, that would go into law, become law?
Yes, the duty to warn would become a legal duty. And I think that's really contentious.
Yeah, I see the look on Margaret's face. Yeah, the dread.
It's just one of dismay. And I think so often we see in medicine, when things go from a professional duty to a legal duty, what happens is enormous fear, potentially a criminal law if you don't do something. And people become, I think, quite frightened. You know, how far are you going to go to trace people or track people down? You know, it becomes, I think, an administrative and bureaucratic nightmare, never mind an emotional and medical one.
Cool. Chip in there, the three judges at the appeal court were very specific. They said, we don't expect doctors to go tracking down people, and we also see that this is a very exceptional situation. But the nuance of that, that's the worry, that the nuance of that might be lost if it then went to a legal duty.
Yeah, and I think we've seen that so often once difficult professional decisions start to get put into a legal framework. The breaking of confidentiality is such a rare thing for a doctor to do. You know, it's a seminal event in your career. I'm sure there are doctors who will recall the time they had to break confidentiality, for example, after they advised someone who was unsafe to drive not to drive, for example, something that you're legally bound to do, you must protect the public. I think if a doctor had to do that, you would remember that in your career as something that was very difficult, something that cost you sleepless nights, I'm sure, and was hard to make a judgment on, even when it's clear, because it's seen as such an enormous thing for a doctor to do.
Anna, to be fair, I would imagine that in the vast majority of cases like this, the family would have been told, and that the individual concerned, the father in this case, would want the family informed.
Oh, absolutely. And practice over the last 30, 40 years in clinical genetics has shown that that is the case. And it's very, very unusual where people are absolutely adamant that they don't want their relatives to know. And even when people are unsure about contacting their relatives, a conversation with a genetic counsellor to have support in doing that is often what happens. And then people feel that they then can. But it is a very tricky thing to do. You know, families are often very disparate and spread apart, and you know, how do you actually do it? You know, do you email those cousins that you haven't spoken to in 20 years? Oh, in what words do you use? How do you frame it? I mean, these are tricky conversations.
The problem with this is that it has potentially enormous ramifications. Instead of assuming confidentiality, we might have to start assuming that people should know unless there's a reason otherwise, for example. And I think it's going to be hard to decide what genetic conditions are such that are of a severe enough nature that relatives must be informed by rote, because many genetic conditions are mixed, are not always fully expressed, for example. I think it's going to be very difficult and will create a huge amount of grey areas that will cause ethical difficulty, not just for doctors, but for patients and families.
Anna, one thing for sure, I mean, we're right at the beginning of the gene revolution. I mean, this is likely to become more of an issue rather than less.
It's definitely going to become more of an issue. And that's simply because genetic testing itself has just gone mainstream. So historically, you could only order a genetic test through specialist clinical genetic services. And now the Genomic Medicine Service has been announced with plans to revolutionise genomics across the whole of the NHS, where anybody can order a genetic test pretty much. And genomic testing is relevant in ENT, dermatology, obstetrics, fetal medicine. It's just gone everywhere. And so the issues about, you know, an individual's genetic test results and what that means for them and their family are going to become part of conversations in clinical practice across the whole of the NHS. And this raises issues about whose information is this? Genetic information, we've often felt and seen as family information, certainly from the specialist clinical genetic services. We see it as belonging to the family as opposed to the individual. Whereas that shift in thinking is not there yet across the whole of the NHS. So there's quite an urgent need to upskill healthcare professionals everywhere, really, on the implications of this sort of testing the uncertainty that goes with it, and some of the ethical issues raised. Even if you are not having a genetic test yourself in the NHS at the moment, somebody that you're biologically related to might be, or they might be having a direct-to-consumer ancestry test or a 23andMe test or some of the direct-to-consumer testing that you can get online. And so it's kind of relevant to all of us, whether we're actually patients at the moment or not, or whether we're just patients in waiting, or whether we're just citizens in society.
Anna Middleton, and there's more information on the case on the Inside Health page of the Radio 4 website. Now to another story that's been in the news.
A nagging sore throat may be an early sign of cancer.
Just one of a number of similar headlines generated by new research into cancer of the voice box. And it piqued our interest because, judging by my experience anyway, they might have worried quite a few people. The study was led by Willie Hamilton, Professor of Primary Care Diagnostics at the University of Exeter, and earlier I spoke to him via our Exeter studio. Apologies for the sound quality. It wasn't a great line, and Willie has to use a mobile phone to link to his cochlear implant so that he can hear me. So, was he happy with the coverage in the media?
It was obviously hyped up quite a lot, and the mainstream media picked up a lot of the sore throat issue, and arguably didn't pick up the truth behind that. So, yes, it was hyped up a bit.
Well, we've got you here now, so you tell us the truth. What exactly did you find?
We found out which symptoms are important for laryngeal cancer in primary care. We confirmed that hoarseness mattered. We've all get hoarse from time to time with germs. And many of our patients just suffer this at home, take paracetamol or whatever they want to take, and get better without doctors getting involved. But it's hoarseness that persists. Secondly, we found other symptoms that wouldn't normally have been considered to be laryngeal cancer. The one that got a lot of publicity was sore throat. But it has to be remembered that this was sore throat in the over 60s and persistent sore throat that patients were reporting to the GP a couple of times. So one of the findings we found, which hasn't been publicised, was that sore throat on its own only had a chance of 1 in 700 of being laryngeal cancer. But persistent sore throat, where the patient aged over 60 returned to the GP and had other symptoms like earache or difficulty swallowing, those were the patients at risk, and at considerable risk. Their risks were up in the 5% range.
So they had a 1 in 20 chance or thereabouts of having an underlying cancer of the larynx. And that's above the threshold that we would refer someone urgently to be seen under the two-week rule.
And the good news, of course, is the ENT surgeon has an easy test if he thinks laryngeal cancer is a possibility. A laryngoscope, which is a flexible small tube which can be passed through the nose and down, look at the voice box, and is easy, quick way of looking at the larynx. We GPs don't have that equipment, so it requires referral.
Willie, let's just set the scene a little bit. Tell me what we know about laryngeal cancer in terms of how common it is, who gets it, and what the current cardinal symptoms are.
Well, it's rare. There's just under 1,800 new cases a year, 10 times smaller than colorectal cancer. 80% roughly in men, more common in smokers. And you ask me, what did we know about the symptoms? The answer is we didn't know much. I was involved in helping to formulate the NICE guidelines in 2015. And we had no evidence from primary care about which symptoms mattered. We assumed some of the symptoms reported from specialists would be right. So we said hoarseness, also said lump in the neck. Oddly, our results showed the second one of those to be wrong.
And so for somebody listening who's had a sore throat for a week or two and they're in their 30s, they're non-smoker and they're otherwise healthy, this research really doesn't have any relevance to them.
Yeah, they treat themselves. I've got a sore throat today, Mark. I've had it for 2 weeks and I'm not seeing my GP.
Willie Hamilton. And there's an overview of the Exeter study findings on our website. Low-carb diets are very much en vogue at the moment, mainly among people keen to shift excess weight. But there's another use that's had nowhere near as much coverage, and it's well established. Very low-carbohydrate or ketogenic diets can help people with epilepsy. Toddler Edward Harding had his first seizure when he was a baby, a moment his parents, Sky and Peter, will never forget.
The day was like, there's nothing to provoke it. Just a normal day, went shopping. We just had dinner, sat him down, watching the TV, and then he leant to his left-hand side, just started having a seizure.
Scary.
Yeah, it was really scary. He's never done it before, so I didn't know what to do. So I got him out and then rang an ambulance straight away. He stopped by the time the paramedics got there. Just as they were putting him in the ambulance, he went into another seizure as well for another 10 minutes.
Peter rang me, so I come to the hospital.
In quite a state, I would imagine.
Yeah, very upset. He was in resus. I was being sick because I was so scared because I'd never seen it before. So we got discharged after a week. He was on antibiotics. 2 weeks later, I woke up at 5:30 and it sounded like he had hiccups. I actually looked at him and he was fit. And so obviously I got him out, called an ambulance. And we got taken down to hospital. He went status for 2 hours.
That's continual?
Continual seizures.
Yeah.
He was pumped with 5 different rescue medications. A crash team were called. And then he was put in the adult ICU. And
Intensive care. They
finally got it under control.
Give me an idea over the last couple of years of how many different types of medications he's tried.
So he's tried 4 different medications and none of them have helped.
And when you say none of them have helped, that meant he's carried on having seizures?
Yeah.
How frequently?
Yeah. So every day.
Sometimes he has absent seizures up to like 30 times a day.
Yeah.
So he sort of appears to switch off for a bit?
Yeah, he just zones out for a few seconds and comes back.
And he can drop and he does hit his head and things like that.
I mean, you always have to keep an eye on a toddler, but a toddler,
you literally cannot take your eyes off of him.
Yeah. Did all the medicines that he was taking, did they have an effect on him?
Yeah, he's very, very sleepy. In November, we had clinic with our neurologist. He wanted to add another drug and just up and up his medication, and then I had to say no because it's not Edward anymore. He's just like a different child. So then he said the alternative is that he could be referred to go onto a ketogenic diet.
So my name is Helena Champion. I'm a paediatric dietitian working at Cambridge University Hospital. So we've known that altering your food so that you make ketones has been beneficial for seizures since the early 1920s. When you have a low-carbohydrate diet, your body will stop using glucose as its primary source of energy in the blood and start making alternative fuel by burning fat. So you can either burn the fat that you eat on a daily basis, or you can burn your body fat. And as you burn that fat, you make ketones as a side product.
So the basic principles are to increase ketone levels, to decrease sugar levels. And what's beneficial in the ketogenic diet, do we think? It's those ketones or the lack of carbohydrate?
It's probably a little bit of both, and it might actually be neither of those, but the other products that come along when you make ketones may also affect how seizures initiate. But we also know that ketones can act like a drug in that they actually will change the neurotransmitters in the brain. So another way that ketones can affect whether your seizures will start is by having a drug-like effect, a physical effect of actually stopping that neurotransmitter initiation.
Dampening down electrical activity, effectively.
Yeah.
And what about the role of the lack of sugar, because essentially all carbohydrates are broken down into sugars. Could it be that the lack of sugar is important too?
Indeed. So we get a flattening of blood sugars when we go on a low-carbohydrate diet. And there are some theories that show that even without ketones being present, you can improve seizure control.
And are we sure that this diet works well?
In 2012, the NICE guidelines recommended as a therapy for children with complex epilepsy that the ketogenic diet is effective. So we talk about complex epilepsy as a child who has failed 2 targeted medications to control their seizures, and we should be thinking about ketogenic diet amongst a range of other therapies at that point in your journey.
So we started the diet on December the 1st. Seizure-wise, we hardly have any absence anymore, so we maybe have like 5 a day, maybe.
And he was having 30 of these before.
Yeah, 30, 40 a day. The tonic-clonic and the focal seizures haven't gone.
These are the bigger seizures.
But I'm hoping that time goes on, that his body starts to get used to it all.
Have they explained why his epilepsy's been so hard to control?
He had a basic gene panel done that was negative, but now they've done a more detailed one.
So at the moment they don't know, but they think it could be something genetic.
Because he has developmental delay as well, that's quite normally linked to genetics.
But you're pleased with the impact so far?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, his walking's really improved. I think his speech is getting a little bit better.
Because it's quite a lot of work, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It's a ketogenic diet.
Yeah.
It sounds simple, following a special diet. But the principal idea is that he has little or no carbohydrate.
So it's an individual-based diet. All meal plans are done by the dietitian.
And what were you told about the likely impact?
They usually say 2 years before you start to wean off drugs.
So that would be the aim, hopefully, that if he's well controlled, that you might be able to reduce one of the medicines that he's taking.
Yeah, definitely.
He's a big lad, though, isn't he?
Yeah, very big lad. Yeah, he is.
He looks healthy and strong.
Yeah, he is.
Typically, in our centre, we will have children who've tried 3, 4, 5 medications before they're referred to try ketogenic diet therapy. It's most important with epilepsy that you do get control of the seizures. And we know that for non-complex epilepsy, the drugs are very, very good. But there's this group of around 30% of all epilepsies that don't respond well to those targeted first therapies. And so they're much more difficult to control.
What about its role earlier on? I mean, parents might understandably want to try something like this earlier on as an alternative to drugs, or maybe along with the first drug.
So there are some studies going on to see if it has the same effect if we bring it into the mix of therapies earlier on, but those studies have still not been tried.
What sort of response do you expect to see?
What we're looking for is stopping seizures going on for more than half an hour, because if you have a seizure that goes on for any length of time over the half hour, then you'll get decreased oxygen levels to the brain, and that can cause some permanent changes. In this group of children with complex epilepsy, if we were to put in a 4th, 5th, 6th drug, we'd expect 5%, so 1 in 20 of children, to get a good clinical response in their seizure control. When we put the diet in at this same point, we get around a 60-70% clinical response to putting the diet in. So it's very effective, but it's a very onerous therapy to do because it's every meal of every day with no days off. As soon as you put carbohydrate into the diet, you stop making ketones and you can get some breakthrough seizures.
Is there any evidence of any harm done through the low carbohydrate side of this? The fact that they're not getting the carbohydrate and energy that they normally would? Or can they get it all from fat and protein?
As long as your blood sugars remain above a critical low level, then there's absolutely no problem with having the low carbohydrate diet. Younger children under the age of 2 are more at risk of having low blood sugars.
How long would they be on this diet for? Is it potentially lifelong?
So no. So the recommendations are that we try the diet for 12 weeks. If you're a responder and get good control over your seizures, we run the diet for 2 years. And then about 80% of the children at 2 years, when we bring them off the diet, they find they maintain their seizure burden as if they were on the diet. And about 20%, their seizures are worse and they elect to go back on the diet. So it is a therapy you can do for a longer term. But we find at 2 years, epilepsy may well have changed and the brain has become more resilient, and so you don't actually need the therapy at that point. So the diet's not a cure, but it allows the brain a bit of breathing space to gain its resilience to actually manage to control the seizures itself.
What proportion of patients that you see or their families manage to maintain the diet to the required standard? It's quite a difficult diet to follow.
Yeah, we don't not have mistakes, but they get back onto diet because they know their child is much better on it. And also our teenagers know they're better on it. So they often say to us, I don't like it, but I feel better on it, so I'll stick with it.
Paediatric dietitian Helena Champion talking to me at Adam Brooks Hospital. And there are more details on the ketogenic diet on the website. We end the programme on a lighter note. A transatlantic spat. A picture posted by Andy Murray while recovering after his hip surgery last week prompted criticisms by doctors from America that his right arm was too hairy. They think it should have been shaved before a cannula and drip were put into his veins to reduce the risk of infection. But are they right? Time to call in umpire Margaret McCartney. Margaret, a contentious area?
There's a delicious debate about this that actually goes back decades in medicine. So I don't know if you remember, you're probably too young, Mark, but in the 1960s and 70s, women were routinely told to shave their perineums, their bottoms, when they were expected to give birth to a baby vaginally in order to make the process somehow hygienic. Absolute rubbish. There was never any evidence whatsoever that this prevented infections afterwards, which was supposedly the aim of it. So since then, I think there has been a bit more of an interrogation of the evidence around routine preoperative shaving or shaving before you put in cannulas or drips. Now, to be fair to the US organisation, the Association for Vascular Access, they stated that Sir Andrew Murray's arm hair should be clipped rather than shaved. And it's a different thing. Shaving is a more invasive process where the surface of the skin is very often damaged, whereas clipping, the idea is, doesn't damage the surface in quite the same way. But to be honest with you, Mark, I still think they're wrong.
I mean, the idea makes sense, doesn't it? If you're going to have something put into your arm, I mean, he's got very hairy arms. You wouldn't want all the plaster stuck to all the hair. So you can see why people might do it. But what's the downside?
There's two parallel issues, I think. One is this idea that clipping is better than shaving. And one is, why shave or try to remove hair at all? And I think medicine's got itself in a bit of a mess in that it has traditionally viewed hair as being something a bit dirty and something a bit unhygienic, which I don't really think is the case very often at all. Now, some surgeons might say that it makes them easier to do a good job if they have a clear field, if there's no hair and a hairy person at their site of surgery. Perhaps that may be true. But the argument here is around whether or not putting in an intravenous cannula in a hairy arm is made safer in view of infection risk by removing some of that hair, either by shaving or by clipping. Shaving, there's certainly evidence that it does harm. We don't want to do that. It seems to damage the skin surface, make it easy for bacteria to get where they shouldn't be, particularly in or near a cannula or a catheter, whatever you're putting in. Clipping, there's a bit more of a ambiguous situation. There is no clear evidence that clipping makes infection less likely. The argument may be that clipping makes it easier to put dressings on to fix the intravenous cannula better in place so that it's less likely to be damaged. But there is no high quality evidence that says that is the case.
And looking at this as a man who's also got a hairy arm, the other advantage, of course, is that when you remove the dressings, once you leave the hospital, if you've been clipped, I suppose it's much less painful.
Well, we actually don't know that for sure. So we don't know whether there's a difference in pain where the hair has been clipped rather than left alone. And there's also lots of different types of dressings. And of course, some dressings are more adherent than others. And certainly there's lots and lots of gaps in the evidence about which dressing is, I suppose, less painful to take off at the end of the day, and also which is less likely to cause infection while it's in.
So if you've got to make a decision as umpire, you're voting for...
Very much with the British and Scottish team here.
Thank you very much, Margaret. Just time to tell you about next week, when I try a high-tech alternative to medication for troublesome migraine and new research into hemochromatosis, a condition which can cause problems ranging from fatigue and lack of sex drive to arthritis and liver disease. And yet it's often missed, despite being relatively easy to diagnose. Join me to find out why.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.